And so the news, Joe Biden is the vice presidential pick for Barack Obama. My wife and I actually met him. We had contrasting experiences, which may or may not be enlightening, but might color your perception of Joe Biden. And in addition to what you might have already read about him. By the way, this is the Dave Gordon Show, aptly called because I am Dave Gordon. This is the show where we talk about everything under the sun. It's a vibrant mix of pop culture, politics, and moral clarity. I've worked in some of North America's top newsrooms, enabling me to give you the knowledge and unique perspective on the issues of the day. So my wife and I, in March 2007, were at the American-Israel Political Action Committee Conference in Washington, D.C., where we also happened to have met Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton. But I'm going to talk about Joe Biden. He was so open to and so welcoming to people who wanted to meet him. It was surprisingly refreshing, actually, because Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton had the velvet rope, and you could only shake their hands, and you couldn't ask them questions, and you couldn't get near them. But Joe Biden, it was the very opposite. It didn't even look like he had security. He was actually covered in maybe 100 people, 150 people. Of course, you know, nobody really knew or cared who he was at the time. My wife had a campaign poster, and she went up to Joe Biden and she said, "Sir, may I please have your autograph?" And Joe Biden said, "Oh yes, it was very polite of you to ask. Thank you very much." And he signed it. And I think he was surprised to not have something shoved in his face with a pen. We subsequently gave that autograph away as a gift to a friend, not having realized its worth. For my experience, that same evening, I went up to him and I recorded on my MP3 recorder the question and answer, and you'll be able to find this and download it on www.davegordonwrites.com. That's davegordonwrites.com, my website, where you'll find all kinds of podcasts and interviews, including the one that I had, the brief moment with Joe Biden. I went up to him and I said, "Sir, I'd like to ask you, what's your plan for Iraq?" And he said, "See my website." I said, "Yeah, but sir, what's your plan for Iraq?" "Oh, see my website." And his handler pushed me away, almost as if I was saying something forbidden. He was very dismissive to my mind, very glib. I don't think he had a real answer. He voted for the war, but then he changed his mind. And that, I think, is going to be something of the media is going to pick at if the media finds Iraq a topic to continue talking about. His war stance was that he voted for it, but he said lately, when it was convenient, if I knew then what I knew now, I would not have voted for it. And I always thought that was an odd statement. How would you have known then what you know now? And what would have you known? What we didn't know was that people in Iraq would be slaughtering one another. They would be slaughtering their own to fight their liberators. Because this has never happened in history. In Nazi Germany, the Germans never murdered themselves to prevent the U.S. from taking over Germany. There was no experience of this form of evil ever. Few people could have predicted this. There was no way to know what we were up against. From what I could see, the fight against Islamofascism, and by the way, during all of the Democratic presidential debates, they never said the word Islamofascist, or Islamic terrorist. And they stayed away from those names, which is very telling. I think it's the Democrats who are putting the stumbling blocks in front of us. And that cannot be overstated. The utter and total damage we will see, and Iraq will fall apart if we don't stay the course. If I was an Iraqi who was fighting for freedom, I'd say, you Americans, you support us for a period of time, but when the right results don't come in, you abandon us the way that you abandoned those who wanted freedom in Vietnam. So this Iraqi fighter just waits around for the enemy to slaughter his children. The Democrats, they don't want a bulwark to prevent this from getting worse. This is what I would think of if I was an Iraqi who loved freedom. My contempt for that part of America that wanted to leave would be incredibly deep. Why do you bother to proclaim that you are all about liberty? Our fighters in our country are prepared to die for liberty, but you want to abandon us? What happens if we leave? Isn't it interesting the Democrats have never mentioned anything about what would happen if we left? They just talk about, well, we have to leave, but what would happen if we would leave? They don't say. Because the United States loses a handful of soldiers, according to the Democrats, it's time to leave. And that's all it is, folks. When you compare it to Iraqi deaths or other wars, it's really a small fraction of people who died. Now, every death is a real tragedy. But as Thomas Jefferson once said, if you're not prepared to fight for liberty, you don't deserve it. Joe Biden, I don't think, gets it. When I asked him, what's your plan for Iraq? Sir, what's your plan for Iraq? And you can download this off my website, davegordonwrites.com. Go see my website, he says. He had no real answer. He couldn't worm his way out of it. Democrats, I think their priority is, we deserve a 35-hour work week. We deserve socialized medicine. That's what concerns the Democrats, not fighting evil, because they think Americans don't have it easy enough. The greatest evil, says Obama, is poverty. He actually said so. So we go, we make a promise to the Iraqi people. It didn't work out immediately, so we have to leave the problem in the legs, in the laps of the Iraqis. We have to just plop it on their laps. So long, have a nice day. Barack Obama said, we have to put world opinion back on its feet. So doing what is right in the world isn't important, but being loved is. There is no correlation between doing what is right and being loved. None. The relative popularity of a position should never dictate its morality. And I think that's Barack Obama's biggest problem, and by default, Joe Biden's. How many deaths are too many? They don't say. At what point should we leave? At what point is it okay to stay? How few deaths would it have been for us to stay the course? Why would anybody trust the Americans after this? Why would anybody want them on their side if they're just going to say, well, we've decided it's time to go. Going got tough. So long, folks. How much is freedom worth? When we were fighting the Nazis, 500,000 people, 500,000 allies, they were killed. Should we have just said, okay, France, England, Poland, well, our counter says that it's 500,000, and that's a little too much for us. How about the American Civil War? What if the South had said, hey, look, you know, 500,000 soldiers from the North were killed in this fight to free the black slaves. And the Northerners, what would they have said? Should they have said, wow, 500,000 Unionists, that's a lot. Maybe after all, the freeing the black slaves isn't worth it. That's just too high a price. Well, tell your black friends who breathed free. It was because 500,000 Unionists fought the Confederates to free black slaves. You can see some of this in my one of my newest articles on DaveGordonWrites.com. It's called Iran and the Crosshairs, and I talk about a lot of this stuff. In the meantime, we have a great lineup, and without further ado, I'd like to get straight to it. Coming up, we have Barbara Kay, who's a columnist for the National Post. And after that, we're going to have Mike Fagelman, Honest Reporting Canada's executive director, talking about some egregious media bias and gaffes against Israel. And later, Anne Baevsky is going to join us. She is not only an outspoken UN critic, but she's also a human rights expert. And these three folks are all coming up. And we're going to go straight to Barbara Kay.
This is Barbara Kay. She's a columnist for the National Post. Welcome to the show, Barbara.
Hi, Dave. Nice to be here.
The first thing I wanted to ask you about was your newest column, which I found extremely fascinating. It's a veteran writer, a five-year columnist of the National Post, marking her half-decade anniversary at the Post with a guidance to young journalists who aspire to do what you do, I assume. What was the inspiration for the article?
The actual inspiration was twofold. One was plain serendipity. I received a request in my inbox on the morning when I was trying to think of a column to write. It was a student, a high school student, requesting advice and also comments about my style or you know, the kind of approach I take to my work, because she was doing an assignment for her English, her advanced English course. So that kind of sparked my recollection of other such requests that I had. But it was serendipity also, in the sense that the column that I had meant to go in, I had already written the day before, and the editor had said no, they couldn't use it because it was slightly controversial, and they weren't, you know, they thought it would be better not to go in, and so I said, well, do you mind if I blog it? And I sent it off to a blog. There was nothing illegal about it or anything, but...
What was it about, by the way?
Well, the topic was a spin-off from a story that came out of a case that is still before the law court. It's a spectacularly miserable divorce case that is presently before the Court of Appeal, and that was the reason that they really didn't want to put in my, the topic itself had nothing to do with the actual divorce. It had to do with a potential scandal around the legal aid that one of the parties was receiving. So, although it didn't touch on the issues in the divorce case, my editors thought, you know what, let's not get involved in a case before the court. So I sent it off to a legal blog, but that left me with nothing for my Wednesday column, and I had to get it in before noon on Tuesday, so I was sitting there in front of my computer at 7:30 Tuesday morning and saying, what am I going to write about? And in came this email. So I said, you know what, that's what I'm going to write about. And so I did. I used this young woman's questions as a springboard to, because it coincided with the fact that I had been thinking to myself, gee, you know, 5 years has gone by very quickly, and I've learned a lot in those 5 years, and look how lucky I am to have this gig. You know, I say that to myself every Wednesday morning when I open the newspaper, and oh my God, I'm in. You know, it's still a very pleasant kind of shock to me.
What sort of advice would you give, and what sort of advice did you give in the column?
Well, in the column, she wanted to know what were my inspirations, or how do I get my ideas for columns. Her first question really was, what does it take to be a columnist? And basically, I wanted to reassure her that you don't have to be the world's most brilliant writer. You know, there's very few Mark Steins, Christopher Hitchens, Tom Wolfe. You know, this is not the general run of opinion journalists. It's not that you have to be a great writer. You have to be a competent writer. You know, you nowadays you can't depend on copy editors to change your grammar and your, you know, fix your spelling and your that sort of thing. So you have to be fairly competent and know the rules. But you also have to know something beyond your opinion. And I stress the fact that, you know, good journalists know something about history, and they know they have a broader perspective than just current events. And one of her questions was, well, where do you get your ideas? And I said, well, you know, from current events, but also from the knowledge and the what I've studied over the years. And I'm constantly reading books and magazines and other opinion journalists. And so, it went like that. If I had had what I didn't put in this, but what I have said to other young people who ask me for advice, is if you're not already in journalism school, think twice before going to journalism school. Most of the really excellent journalists that I know never went to journalism school. And I think a young person's time would be better spent acquiring the kind of knowledge that will be useful to their writing, like a strong basis in history, in economics, in political science. My particular background is English literature. That has served me very well, because when you've read many of the world's great writers, those writers, even though it's literature, they have dealt with the social issues, the cultural issues that come up again and again and again. And you see that even though the times change, there are certain basic facets of human nature that are constant. And that's my guide in many of the, you know, the opinions I advance.
It's interesting that you mentioned that, because about 15 years ago, when I began an interest in journalism as a career, I started asking a lot of people. So I asked the journalism school people and non-journalism school people, and the consensus tended to lean towards exactly what you said, and the criticisms of journalism school were that it was writing by method, by formula, and by theory, and not by practice.
I just think it's great if you can help somebody young who doesn't even know what they're capable of, and help them organize their thoughts, perhaps, for journalism. It's a great career.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's not a big money career, but it's, I don't know, I'm having a wonderful time.
A lot of people are talking about the possible crunch of print journalism. I read recently that the Toronto Star's readership has gone down. The Post is up for sale. I don't know if you knew about this.
Well, I keep hearing that rumor, but I've been hearing that for 10 years, so, or 5 years anyway, since Conrad sold it to... is it seriously up for sale, or is that a rumor?
Yeah, I read it in the Globe.
I did too, and I immediately called John, and I said, is it true? Is it true? He says, not that I know of. He said, you know, these rumors start all the time, and he says, I've been hearing the same rumor for years, but... He says nothing's materialized. There's nothing to show that it's anything but a rumor, as far as, you know. He says, but maybe I'll be the last to know. So I don't know. He says I have learned to disregard these rumors. But you're right. Print journalism for sure is at a crossroads. Well, it was at a crossroads. It's going down. You know, everybody knows that.
Mm-hmm.
And online is going up. But how can online pay people? That's the problem, you know. So it's true. We're at a. I feel that people that get into print journalism now have to realize that they're getting into a medium that is not advancing. It's retreating.
Or they have to find a way to merge with, online with print.
Yeah, which I think they're all trying to do. I mean, the Post is certainly beefing up its. And merging, you see references in the print to the online, and the online to the print, and they put the stuff that's going in print the next day, they put it into the online. So, yeah, they're trying to make it a sort of a meshed adventure. So I have no idea where it will end up, but I hope that print outlives me, because when the day comes that I can't get a newspaper rolled up at my front door to read with my morning coffee, it'll be a very sad day.
What authors, what columnists most inspire you? Who do you look for if you are most fascinated as writers?
I love the kind of writing that David Brooks does. He's sort of a crunchy conservative. He's not extreme. There's a sort of lightness of tone, and yet he always conveys a great deal of knowledge. You always walk away, you know, David Brooks, who writes for the New York Times,
mm-hmm.
You walk away saying, okay, I've read something really, really educational here, but clever, with an original kind of point of view. I love Rex Murphy because he has an extraordinarily personal, individual voice, because he's steeped in great literary knowledge, and he has such dignity and such moral passion behind his writing, and I love his ironic sense, his wit, his biting, you know, kind of humor, and also because he's not extremely ideological, but, you know, he sort of stands for a kind of timeless sense of right and wrong, and cuts through all the baffle gab. So I do like him very much. Mark Stein, of course, for his sheer pyrotechnics, you know, I think he's right on most things, and also it's just kind of, it's like eating a banana split, you know, instead of nobody else's yogurt, and like, so he's a tremendous treat. So the big guys, you know, Christopher Hitchens, I don't agree with everything. A lot of his stuff, I think, is ridiculous, his whole atheism rant. But when he's on, he's spectacular, and also because he's so prolific. This guy does book reviews, he does politics, he does, you know, films. He just amazes me. So he's somebody I really like a lot. I enjoy Margaret Wente at the Globe. She's got humor and common sense. I think these are the qualities that keep coming back when I speak about who I like. They're people with good common sense, and they're not married to one particular ideology. They can look at an issue, and you know, not as a conservative or a liberal. They just say, well, what's the bottom line here, and what would be the right way to go? What would be the humane thing to do, and yet the reasonable thing to do? So people that kind of convey that sense of rational, humorous, George Jonas is amazing. I love him. Robert Fulford is great. These are the, you know, the grand old guys of Canadian journalism.
Sure.
Yeah, and of course Conrad Black is kind of amazing in his own way too, although sometimes a little too erudite for me. But I find him sometimes a little dense for the medium. You know, journalism is something you want to be able to read and absorb pretty rapidly. But for serious writing, I think he's tops. I think Joseph Epstein is one of my favorite writers. They're just so on top of their form. They have such a firm voice, high conviction, and yet there's always a kind of good-humored approach. There isn't this angry... I think journalists that are always angry about something, the first couple of times you read them, you know, you say, yeah, that's true. And then you get used to it, and it's hard to sustain anger and still, you know, make your effect. So I would rather read people who are kind of laid back, and the point comes at you in a, yeah, that is a good point. You know, when you're, like, Ann Coulter's fun, first three or four columns, and then you had to read her every week, it would be like, oh, man, you know, in front of a fire hose, you know.
Yeah, no, she's a one-note writer. Overdose on that one note. Unlike Hitchens, where sometimes he'll write about Legend or Iraq or a book review, and he goes all over the map. And, I really appreciate that, just also for the craft, but also for the eclectic path he's taken.
Well, I think what it comes down to is I admire people who do have the ability to go from one subject to another with relative ease, because they're kind of Renaissance figures, and they have not kept their own education narrow. They're people who read and who see films and who appreciate the world through many lenses. So you have a sense of confidence in their judgment because they haven't been sitting in an ivory tower somewhere only poring over their own subject. You know, they're kind of open to the world and mm-hmm. friendly to the world, because they find the world, they're very eager to explore. So you want to get that sense that this is somebody, hey, I'd like to meet this guy, you know, or this woman. She's, you know, there's a voice there. There's a voice that has warmth and acuity and some wit. I have to, you know, there has to be wit. There has to be a kind of pleasure in the art of writing that you can sense.
Hmm.
You know, sometimes I read the Globe, and it's called the Gray Lady for a reason, you know. Not to dump on other newspapers, but I look at the comment section there, and I find it gray, because the writers are, well, Mark Twente is very good, Marcus G is good, but there's a sort of sameness and a predictability, and there's not a lot of energy. There's not a lot of dynamism, I find, in their whole section. It's kind of, there's something watered down about it, and a kind of fear of putting yourself out there a bit.
Oh, it was a great pleasure to talk to you, Barbara.
Oh, thanks, Dave. It was a really great pleasure to be here, and it was a nice subject to talk about.
Businesses in Southern Ontario have relied on MIT Consulting for their information technology needs. We provide a full range of services and products, including technical support, network and telephone systems installation, web design and hosting, and more. Visit us online at mitconsulting.ca or call us at 416-250-1040. Find out what MIT Consulting can do for your business today. MIT Consulting is proud to support the Dave Gordon Show.
So we're here with Mike Fagelman. He's the Executive Director of Honest Reporting Canada. Mike, tell us what you do at Honest Reporting Canada.
Thanks for having me on the show today. I really appreciate it. Honest Reporting is basically, it's a media watchdog. We're based in Toronto and in Montreal, and our goal and our mandate is to ensure fair and accurate Canadian media coverage of Israel and the broader Middle East.
Types of things do you do to keep an eye on the media and how they portray Israel?
So there's a variety of methods that we're able to actually monitor the media. For one, we have a staff based out of Montreal and Toronto who are scrupulously reading different newspapers, whether in French or in English. We digitally archive various television and radio broadcasts and watch them for issues of balance, whether they're telling the complete story of the Middle East, for accuracy, whether the facts are actually there. We want to make sure that opinion isn't disguised as news. And a lot of the time, we have about 20,000 members from coast to coast. Regular Canadians drop us an email and say, you know, you should take a look at this, or I'm not sure if this is problematic. Could you lend us your expertise and let me know if I should contact a particular media outlet to voice our concerns?
What are some of the most common mistakes, the most common problems that journalists run into so often that you're just finding that this is all too common?
Sure. I think one of the most difficult things a journalist has to do is try to maintain his or her neutrality. And a lot of the times when talking about what could be the most difficult issue to write on the world today, which is the Arab-Israeli conflict, using different terms like terrorist or militant, insurgent, that seems to be a very difficult thing for them to do. CBC, for instance, finds that their actual policy is to use the term militant instead of using terrorist or any of the other variants. And from their perspective, they feel that that's achieving some kind of neutrality. It's really sanitizing the reality because Canadians are informed that organizations like Hamas and Islamic Jihad, Alex of Mars Brigade are terrorist organizations. So in terms of language, the media are constantly bombarded with complaints from either side, and that's a very difficult thing for them to do. A couple other examples. The media constantly refer to returning the Gaza Strip back to the Palestinians. Language would be in Gaza and the West Bank. Impossible because the Palestinians have actually never had autonomous control of the region. There's a lot of naivete of the media, a lot of ignorance. A lot of it comes by the fact that a lot of the journalists who are posted to the region are basically parachuted there. They don't have the necessary skill set, and they're told to report on really a very difficult issue. And there's kind of a herd mentality that prevails in the region. There's a kind of a lowest common denominator way of thinking, and everyone, just different Mideast bureau chiefs, tell the same story.
You mentioned something very telling about the T word. It's been a controversy. It's been something widely discussed amongst a lot of news outlets, whether or not to use the T word, terrorist, supplant it with militant, insurgent, gunman.
Sometimes activist.
Oh, activist. Yeah. That's my favorite. So there's no distinction between somebody who was walking around with an AK-47 mowing down civilians who haven't done anything innocent on the street, who gets the label activist. You can't be a terrorist. Does your organization point that out to journalists too?
I wouldn't say that it's a wholehearted effort for us to lobby the media to change that type of language. It's something that we did in the past, and the media, to be perfectly honest, aren't as receptive to. It's, for one thing, it's hard to sensitize and educate the media in its own right. But just to give you a particular example, the Globe and Mail 3 weeks ago put out a report about a Palestinian terrorist named Dalal al-Mughrabi, a woman who went onto an Israeli bus and, along with a band of cohorts, shot and killed, I think, 40, and there was an explosion of about 40 Israelis that died. And they described her as a resistance fighter. Now to us, from that perspective, we all know that resistance, it's a euphemism, really, is what it is for describing individuals whose job is to murder innocent Israelis. And we didn't feel that by writing that type of language, didn't educate Canadians about who this woman was and what her intentions actually were. It's a difficult thing to do. I don't think we can make the bold leap of getting the media to change the term resistance to calling them terrorist. The main question, it's an unfortunate thing, but if they can try to maintain some kind of a more neutral language, that's something that we're going for.
I realize that even the media don't know what words to use. Sometimes they will switch back and forth because even the reporter isn't given a solid definition of each one. I would place bets that a place like the Globe and Mail doesn't have a style guide for this stuff, where they outline precisely when do we call him a gunman, when do we call him a militant, when do we call him a resistance fighter, an activist, when do we call him a terrorist. It's just today we're going to be calling them a resistance fighter and we'll cope. So let's go on to the next question. One of the city's most widely respected, renowned, trusted news organization, City TV, you flagged this week a mistake, is it?
Yeah. We called it an unforgiving error, serious, egregious mistake.
Well, then definitely we have to unpack this. What did they do? What did they say?
Sure. So City TV has a news program called City TV International, which is a half-an-hour program about current events going on around the world. They had a feature on August 14th about the Middle East and about that there were scuffles between Israeli soldiers and pro-Palestinian protesters at the West Bank area of Nelin, where the security barrier is being constructed there. And they did a report which alleged that Israeli soldiers had killed 11 pro-Palestinian demonstrators, a claim which is absolutely baseless, and I can tell you authoritatively that nobody died. Some people were injured, but they got it seriously, seriously wrong. So what we did is, and we try not to be strident or reactionary, but simply we called up City TV, brought the error to their attention, and after a little back and forth, they did agree to put out an on-air correction. About 4 days later, they put out what we felt was a very dismal on-air correction. In fact, it wasn't on-air at all. It appeared in a very small text, which indicated that some of the protesters were hurt. The problem with that is, most people are not going to see that dismal correction.
Or even remember what happened 4 days ago.
Or even remember it. Most people are still left with this lingering sense that that Israeli soldiers bellicosely killed 11 pro-Palestinian demonstrators. So from our perspective, we sent out what we call a communique to our members, and we have about 20,000, and from time to time, if they feel so inclined, they write to City TV, and they'll bring their concerns to the publicist's attention or an editor's attention. In this particular sense, we felt that the correction that they put out was not satisfactory. So we're waiting to hear back if they'll either put out a new correction. I sincerely doubt that they would. But a lot of people were very, very upset. I mean, it's a serious libel when it comes down to it, alleging that 11 people were murdered when it didn't happen at all. We would like to see equal time being represented on the same program, with the same hierarchy on the newscast. I think it would be deserving.
What you found and what others found requires a keen observer's knowledge of what had happened. You really have to pour through the facts and the reports. And in this instance, I think honest reporting is correcting a perpetuated fallacy that, I mean, let's face it, maybe City TV got sloppy, maybe they got careless. But there are times in the media where it's not just about careless or sloppy, it's about wittingly using something that an accuracy. For example, I've seen repetitively in the media the reference to the Israeli wall that's being built. And you should be able to know that it's not all a wall. 2-3% a wall, and the rest is barbed wire and fence
and chain link fences
and basic security apparatus to ensure the attacks don't continue in Israel. So it's things like that, I think, that you're also jumping on that lay people can also see. Can you give me maybe an example of something else that a journalist would say but should know better?
Just sticking with the topic of the security barrier, I think what most people don't see and what most of the media don't recognize is that they're constantly putting out pictures of the security barrier and only of the walled sections. And you mentioned that it's 2-3%. It's absolutely true. And the reasons that it's walls is to prevent terrorists from using their sniper rifles to shoot at Israeli children. But most of the time, the images that are appended to articles in different Canadian papers and different international media outlets are pictures of the tall concrete barrier sections. So that's very misleading because it's really not a fair representation of what the security apparatus is. And also, when you see news coverage about it, there's almost oblique reference of the fact that it is there as a security mechanism. And sometimes the media try to couch it as, the Palestinians call it a land grab, the Israelis say it's there for security purposes. That's the media's perspective of finding balance. From my perspective, if they can at least reference Israel's security concerns, I'm content with that. But a lot of the times we're seeing that completely ignored. I'll give you another example. There was a newspaper in Kingston called the Whig Standard that put out a report that alleged that Israeli police officers who had detained a Canadian activist in the West Bank had forced this gentleman to sign a forced confession in Hebrew, a claim that was patent, the veracity of which has not been able to be confirmed, but the newspaper accepts it as true because an activist said it. So they basically wrote it as fact, and that's a lot of the times that we tend to see is that the media accept, different individuals' claims from very problematic backgrounds and very questionable resumes. They accept their claims as true. From our perspective, that was especially problematic. It's a serious human rights violation, a serious violation of due process and protocol at Israeli prisons. And when we complained, they put out a clarification. Again, we felt it's dismal. It's difficult because clarifications are on page 8-2. They're about 20 words. A lot of the times people won't see it. Our goal and our hope is that because we've been able to sensitize them and because they know that we're watching them, they won't do that in the future. So on top of trying to identify and correct the bad media coverage, we really want to prevent it from happening again.
I totally agree. I think the most important thing to remember, I've discovered that there is, when correcting bad behavior, bad speech, there's the ESP rule. It has to be expeditious, it has to be specific, and through words and actions, promise not to do it again. Mm-hmm. And if you can get the promise not to do it again, then, okay, maybe you didn't get the expeditious and specific, but the problem isn't going to be repeated, and hopefully through virtue of the good stuff in days to come and months to come and years to come, that it will outweigh the bad stuff. Let me ask you about moral equivalence. This is a tricky thing to flag, especially in some newspapers where they feel that if they talk about something that the Palestinians have done, they have to talk about something the Israelis have done. Whether the two are related or whether the two are weighed equally, they have to talk about the two as though the two should be juxtaposed.
Right.
As if to say, for example, today in Israel, three Israelis were killed by an explosive device in a cafe. Meanwhile, in Gaza, two children were shot by Israeli defense forces. And it's not colored by context, but those children very well have been placed in front of snipers who were shooting at the Israeli Defense Forces and used as cover. But the only thing, as far as the reporters is concerned, is that this was as deliberate and as targeted as the aforementioned terrorist activity against the Israelis that were killed. Tell us how Honest Reporting Canada approaches things like moral equivalence.
Sure. It's a difficult thing to tackle, I'm going to be honest, right at the start. Because really what you're pointing out to is something that isn't inaccurate. In other words, there's nothing false about it.
It's a
misleading kind of reporting. I'll just give you a particular example. The front page cover of Newsweek magazine a couple years ago had a picture of a Palestinian female suicide bomber and her victim, the Israeli victim. And there was a profile, I don't know if you saw that.
Yeah.
And basically the story that was told was, it was almost sympathetically portraying and profiling this Palestinian suicide bomber, the reasons and the motivations for why she became a suicide bomber, and a very glossed over description of the actual victim. From our perspective, I mean, drawing that kind of an equivalence, it doesn't educate Canadians or people around the world about who this person was. It's very problematic. It's difficult. It's something that, you know, if you bring to the media's attention, they'll say, well, show me the error. It's something that's almost ambiguous.
Error by omission.
That's true. Yeah, and you mentioned context. Context is a very difficult thing to do. You mentioned the fact that there were some Palestinian boys who might have been shot, and you don't know if they were either used as human shields. A lot of times when you hear, you know, five Palestinians killed, you don't hear the fact that they might have
been... What were they doing?
What they might have been doing, whether they were terrorists. One of the difficulties with that, which the media don't try to use terms, is because of the fact that terrorists aren't in military uniforms, they're in civilian fatigues. It's hard to make that judgment. So they try to just avoid by making that label and just say 10 Palestinians died, versus the fact that when there's an Israeli casualty, they're clearly delineated and identified.
Earlier you had mentioned that you have delegates at an office in Quebec.
That's right.
I think we underestimate the number of media outlets and the number of people who have access to this. Quebec's a province, I think, of 12-13 million people. You also have to monitor them too.
Absolutely. And you know, I would say that some of the reports that go out in the French press sometimes border from just straightforward anti-Israel content, and it sometimes it actually turns into anti-Semitism and virulent anti-Semitism.
Wow.
You know, a couple of examples. I mean, in 2002, there's a La Presse journalist, a guy by the name of Serge Chaplot, who drew a caricature, a cartoon, an editorial cartoon, that depicted then Prime Minister Ariel Sharon eating the head of a Palestinian baby. This is, you know, reminiscent of blood libels we've seen, you know, decades and decades ago. Something that, you know, continues unabated in the French press. It's taken us a couple of years to really get our plan together, but I'm happy to say we were able to launch our presence and office in Montreal and to create a French monitoring unit where we're looking at all of the French newspapers and French radio and television and websites. And there's a lot of content out there. It's also something we want to encourage more people who speak French to write and correspond with the French media. Obviously, in French, it's more effective. Having people from across Canada write in English might not be receptive. So we're looking to create, you know, if you would, cells, local cells all across Canada, starting specifically in Montreal, to engage with the French press.
Now, Israel, it's such a complicated narrative, as there's all kinds of facts and history and context to the conflict. Every day we hear a new story. 8 years ago onward, there isn't a day that goes by that you can't find a story about Israel. Somebody will go to your site and see the errors, and through deduction, learn the right things from the wrong things. But what would be a great place for somebody to really start to learn the basics, so that when they're reading themselves and they want to tell you about an error in the media, they can learn. How does somebody who wants to learn about the Middle East, who wants to learn about Israel, learn? Where do they start?
So apart from going to our website, which I think is a great information provider if you want to, it's www.honestreporting.ca. And we want to consider ourselves an information provider and not just a media monitoring organization. We want to educate people about how to professionally engage with the media. A couple other sources that I think are great. If you've ever read Myths and Facts, a book by Dr. Mitchell Bard, he also has a great website, which is jewishvirtuallibrary.org. Really, any question you could possibly have about any issue, about different UN resolutions, about the conflict, about different countries' claims to certain lands, he's got it incredibly well footnoted and sourced. That's one really great source. Another thing that you can really just very easily do is go to the Israeli government websites, Ministry of Foreign Affairs, go to different Israeli newspapers, Jerusalem Post, Yediot Aharonot, Haaretz if you want. And finally, just do a simple compare and contrast from different Canadian and international media outlets. I think you'll at the very minimum, you'll get a good understanding of what's going on, and you can be informed.
Which I think is very important. If they're going to be interested in Israel and the media, and what the media says about Israel, mm-hmm. and how best to combat it, yeah. knowledgeably.
Yeah, I mean, I go to schools all the time, and I speak at different universities and high schools, and one of the big problems I find is that the students there are not media literate. They are largely ignorant of what's going on, not just with the Middle East file, but with regard to international relations, politics, Canadian politics. It's something that I think we need to change in our school systems as well, is to have students be much more literate about what's going on.
Thanks so much for being on the show, Mike Fegelman, Executive Director of Honest Reporting Canada.
Thank you.
Good luck with everything.
Thank you very much.
And again, the website is
honestreporting.ca.
Thanks again, Mike.
My pleasure.
Seems to be the problem here.
Help me, Tech Man. My computer is a virus.
Just another job for Tech Man.
Kill it, kill it, kill it!
All done. That pesky virus won't cause you any more trouble.
Thank you, Tech Man. How can I ever repay you?
Don't worry. We'll bill you.
Call MIT Consulting today, 416-250-1040, or visit us online at mitconsulting.ca. MIT Consulting, the best solutions for your business.
Just another day on the job for Tech Man.
For the past 5 years, businesses in Southern Ontario have relied on MIT Consulting for their information technology needs. We provide a full range of services and products, including technical support, network and telephone systems installation, web design and hosting, and more. Visit us online at mitconsulting.ca or call us at 416-250-1040. Find out what MIT Consulting can do for your business today. MIT Consulting is proud to support the Dave Gordon Show.
Have you ever considered getting a fashion portrait? Why have a normal photo of yourself when you can be in a professional fashion photo shoot? This is an experience available to every woman. Modeling might be daunting to you, but Iconic You knows how to make your dream come true. We make you feel creative, relaxed, and beautiful. Visit iconicyou.com. Men, give the best gift imaginable. Treat your lady to a day of pampering where she is the center of attention to a team of professionals. We provide you with a makeup artist, stylist, personalized locations, top-of-the-line photography equipment, hand massage and healthy catered food. Plus, we have shot models in both fine art and high couture commercial settings. We bring this to you so that men, you can tell her that she is stunning. She is an icon. Women, be your best and remember it forever. Make your dream come true. Let out your iconic you. For free consultations on how we might collaborate together, please go to www.iconicyou.com.
And we're back. It's the Dave Gordon Show, aptly called because I am Dave Gordon. Welcome back. Hope that you enjoyed the interviews with Barbara Kay, a National Post columnist, and Honest Reporting Canada's Executive Director, Mike Fegelman. Enlightening interviews, both of them. It seems as if, for some reason, we can't get Anne Baevsky on the line, and I do apologize. I know a lot of people were looking forward to her as well as the other guests, but we hope to be able to iron this out perhaps the, not the, if not the next show, then the next show after that, but sooner than later than I hope. And she has a lot of fascinating insights to share about human rights and the United Nations. So a brief plug. She's actually going to be here in Toronto, here in town, September 18th. So it's about 3 weeks from now, enough time to pen it on your calendars. She's going to be at the Beth Tikva Synagogue. She's going to be talking about the Durban 2 nightmare. So for those of you who aren't familiar with Nbiavsky, she's at the Hudson Institute in New York, political science professor of York University and editor of EYE on the UN.org. And she's a member of the International Law Association Committee on International Human Rights Law and Practice. So she and Arye Green, who's the director of Media Central in Jerusalem, are going to be talking about the Durban 2 nightmare. For the time being, I'm going to talk about, well, maybe not a nightmare, but something of a disturbing, something that if I dreamt about it, it would be disturbing. But this is a... It's fact is stranger than fiction. I tell you, I opened up the National Post, and I see two stories juxtaposed to one another, and I couldn't believe my eyes. Okay, on the right hand side, there's a little blurb of Celine Dion getting an honorary doctorate from Laval University, and on the left, a bigger picture of Dr. Robert Ouellet, who is the new Canadian Medical Association director. And if anybody should have gotten any sort of honorary doctorate, it ought to be this guy who's been serving the public in the field of medicine for the past 20-some years. And he's trying to revolutionize the Canadian system to make MRIs and CT scans more available here. But Celine Dion, she received an honorary doctorate from Laval University just the other day on the eve of her mega show on the historic Plains of Abraham for Quebec City's 400th anniversary celebrations. Her home province is going through what many are dubbing Celine-mania as she makes a comeback to Quebec after a 5-year stay in Vegas. Her sold-out shows there, with hundreds of fans lined up outside the famed Chateau Frontenac to get a glimpse of Miss Celine, as everyone affectionately calls her, Celine Nationale. So this woman who is, I think, in her late 30s, she gets an honorary doctorate from a university for being a pop diva. How fascinating is that, that you could work your whole life and be a doctor of medicine and change people's lives and save people's lives? And though I'm sure Dr. Robert Ouellet has had his due and has had his recognition, they're on the same page and they're right next to one another, and she's the one getting the honorary doctorate. Now, I for a while, I was a fan of Celine Dion, if you can believe that. And I know some of you, your jaws are dropping. The guy who talks about moral clarity in politics and pop culture. It's true, in the 90s, when Celine Dion was a youngin, I bought her album Incognito, and Dion chante Plamadon. And I know this stuff, and I speak a little French, and I understood her French albums. I think there's something like 24 of them, and it's unbelievable. And I have about 10 of them at home. Beautiful voice, beautiful tunes. Granted, they were 90s pop bubblegum tunes, but, you know, for the time, they were good. And now she's at Vegas, glitz and glamour and sold out, and all of this stuff that she's been doing spells total Hollywood, total, I don't even know the word for it. She's just gone overboard in superfluity. How's that for you? Basically means superficial stuff. That her pop songs aren't on the charts anymore, and she's, you can imagine like a 39-year-old woman who sings a bunch of songs, puts out a bunch of discs, and gets popular. She's granted a doctorate, you know, granted an honorary doctorate from, okay, and it was Laval University. It wasn't like, you know, Harvard or Princeton. But what is that going to lead to? You know, 2 years ago, Jodie Foster was the valedictorian for Harvard University. She was asked to give the keynote. Jodie Foster, actress. Not anybody who brings, with deference to Jodie Foster, not anybody who brings enlightenment to the world. She has spent the past 25 years in movies. And, okay, so maybe you think that she's a good actor, or maybe you don't think she's... But for goodness sake, in her valedictorian speech, she quoted lyrics from the rap musician Eminem. Isn't that the epitome of class? The epitome of just the higher echelons of respect? Gone are the days when you used to actually have to accomplish something major to get on the cover of Newsweek or get on the cover of Time. And now you just got to do something stupid. You got to put out a bunch of hits and do Vegas for 5 years. Come back to your hometown. And it's not enough to have a concert and be adored by fans and have autograph seekers, throngs of admirers. You got to get an honorary doctorate because it's just so educational. It's just so it spells higher education, whatever it is that you're doing. Oh my goodness, Celine, and on the same page, Dr. Robert Ouellet and his breakthroughs in the Canadian medical industry and what he's trying to do. And they get, you know, granted, he gets about twice as many words and twice as big a picture. But is this really news, folks? Celine Dion, she's, oh my goodness. What is it called? Who's next? What other pop diva is going to be next? She's going to put the honorary doctorate on her wall. It no longer means that you have to go to school to get accreditation, to get respect, to get the long term admiration of people. You just got to be a pop queen. My goodness. Oh, dear. What is this world coming to? Well, that's my rant. I thank you for listening, and I know that you would have rather hear Anne Baevsky talk about Durban and the United Nations, and I apologize to those people who tuned in that we missed her. But we hope to get her again very soon. If not, maybe you could catch her at Beth Tikva Synagogue September 18th, where she's going to be speaking about the Durban 2 nightmare. Well, thank you for listening. So long, everybody. And, of course, next week, we'll be back same that time, same that channel. Thanks for listening, folks.